young revolutionary spiritualists are still with us up to Tuesday. Come and you will see him. He will come and he will beam and like anything. So I think we saved one person's life, if not more, if not even many of you here. That was very, very inspired, and I thank you very, very much. Even the police said, you know, we get some calls. People are just so much. They have almost a little fear to come on the road because you are so many and so loud. And I said, no. They should fear to stay inside their apartments before the television. And they should long to come on the road. And he said, the policeman, yes, it's all right. People have to learn to live with you. he said like this. So it was very pleasant. Hare Krishna. So we have now a wonderful Vaishnava. I understand Kadamba Kanana Maharaj is already here since the beginning of the retreat. We just had a wonderful retreat together in Switzerland, in the mountains, where Maharaj said in his usual way very deep things which moved many devotees and myself also. And I'm very, very happy to conduct this session with him. I think we will be very complimentary because we are a little different perspectives we have. So I'm looking forward to a very lively and hopefully very rewarding question and answer session. How should we conduct? Who is our facilitator? Janaki Ram, maybe? Is he? You look very facilitating.
Shambhala.
I didn't see. Is there someone who guides us through this session?
I think we just, whoever has questions can put the hands up.
Okay. Mm-hmm. Yes, and we will share the questions between us. Mm-hmm. Not all at once, please. Yes?
Krishna Maharaj, please excuse my ignorance. I want to ask a question about Varna, and as I understand in Kali Yuga, we are all Sudra, but is it true that we may have traits of other Varna, and in terms of finding our own natures and perhaps duties in life, is there a way of us to, would you be able to advise a way of kind of finding, discovering our own nature and our own affinity?
I think I will start with this question and then see if Maharaj wants to say something on this. I think behind this question is a very, very deep concern which we all have. The question, where's my place? What should I do? What is my natural strength? And so on. And this all is, can be, we can say it in one question. What is my dharma? The word dharma means, what is my essence? What am I made of? What is my purpose also? And my nature, really. And dharma is composed, that many don't understand, of three elements. Just like this microphone stand, it's called a tripod. It has three stands. Our dharma stands also on three pillars, not just one. The first is our essential nature. And there it is true. Some of us are more practically minded, some of us are more intellectual minded. So in old times you would say the intellectually minded are more Brahminical, and the more practical minded people could be Vaishyas, Kshatriyas, or Sudras. So we have traits of this. This is called our Swadharma. But in our Swadharma we find also things like natural personality traits and so on. We have to find that out, our natures and our talents. Then comes a second form of Dharma, which is to act dharmically. The first Dharma is Dharma in relationship to ourselves. To act dharmically is acting in relationship to others, and keeping something like the Dharma codex, acting ethically for the benefit of others, not lying, not inflicting violence on them. Things which are described in our four rules and regulations. And then there is a third form of Dharma called Sanatana Dharma, that is our Dharma in relationship with the Lord. These tripod of Dharma is important. Mick Jagger, for instance, he is a member of a musical group which has not yet died, but will die soon because of old age, I think. He has found a natural talent. He's an entertainer and singer, but he doesn't act very dharmically towards others. And in terms of Sanatana Dharma, he is also a greenhorn. So therefore, he is unhappy, although he is in his place as an entertainer and so on. So we need to have three things. So in Krishna consciousness, in our movement, we tend to think that if someone gets very strong in his relationship with God, his Sanatana Dharma, the others will naturally follow as byproducts. So by chanting, reading, becoming a good devotee, normally it is shown to you where your place is as it comes. This is a little bit how I would answer your question about the four, the traditional model of the Vana Shram Dharma and so on. You will know where your place is by entering the tripod of Dharma in your Sanatana Dharma. Also, in the Pandavasena Dharma retreat, you can download this and you might get a lot of inspirations how to find. But wait until the new Dharma retreat comes out. I found a totally new approach, I mean traditional approach, but I have added it, and I think with this approach it's very easy for devotees and people to find their Dharma. Mm-hmm. Thank you. Okay. Enough on finding one's Dharma. Yes, others who have a question? Yes, we will. Maharaj,
my question is just on basically in the Western society now, we have devotees trying to practice Krishna consciousness, but the strictness of Vedic culture can't be so much applied, because the culture we come from is completely opposite. But more specifically, when it comes to interacting with ladies, what happens is many men would want to have a very strict life in terms of association. But due to the culture, sometimes ladies feel that men are being ignorant or not so giving them attention, and there should be some sort of interaction there, whereas some men are trying to live a more restricted life. How do you get that balance, or what should be our approach without offending and at the same time not you know, putting ourselves at risk? Mm.
Whereas the last question was a Varna question, this is more an ashram question. So we're kind of coming to a rounded covering of the topic. And when it comes to Varna, it is sometimes more complex to come to identification, to a clear-cut identification amongst Vaishnavas, because Vaishnavas may act in many ways in devotional service as is required. But when it comes to ashram, one has to really make some choices and take the consequences of these choices. When Srila Prabhupada introduced Varna ashram in the Western world, he did so practically in the very early stages of this movement by designating devotees as specially brahmacharis, grihasthas, and so on. And the other ashrams, sannyas was rare. Kirtanananda was the first. And I remember the first social development conference in ISKCON, where they had members of the various ashrams speak. And I remember how the brahmachari was saying that it was very difficult, because he felt like an animal who was kind of hunted upon, you know. He felt that it was very difficult to be a brahmachari in an environment where people would say, the statistics are against you. You have no chance. So, in other words, he felt a great lacking in a culture that was supporting him. The householders also felt unhappy. They also felt that they were not taken serious as spiritual members, as they felt that they were oftentimes seen too much as mundane personalities. And sannyasis, of course, are very few. And finally, we had a vanaprastha who said, "I have an identity crisis. I don't exist." Because where are they? So, when we speak about Varna ashram, it is something that is still very underdeveloped in many ways in terms of putting it into practice. I would rather not have, because my nose is misbehaving. So.
Oh, misbehaving.
Thank you. A lot of green, and I'm not used to it. Now, in a modern society, we may not be able to follow all the traditional forms of Vedic culture, but still, we can accept codes of behavior, and we can make a clear choice. If one is desiring to be single and a brahmachari, then one should join a brahmachari ashram and wear saffron cloth after some time. And then one will find that there is quite some protection. Then also the interaction with ladies becomes more regulated. But if we are like an upakurvana brahmachari, a brahmachari who is thinking of getting married after some time, and who then wants to, for some time, remain single, then it's very difficult. Then it's complicated, because white cloth is a signal available. So, and look at it from a lady's perspective for a moment. I mean, it's like ladies have a small window of opportunity. By the age they're 25, they get an anxiety. So they're getting older, still not married. And then the market is really narrowed down in the devotee movement. So very few men are responsible. Most are just, sort of all over the place and really not understanding what it means to be married, to accept responsibility and care for a woman. So not easy. So therefore, unless one formally joins the brahmachari ashram, it may not be possible to keep that distance between men and women. And one should think about that. One should not automatically get married. One should really think, is it really necessary? Because marriage is an incredible complication, an incredible distraction, which takes so much energy away from Krishna, that would you really want to do that just because of a little bit affliction by lust? You can get married, lust will not go away. You'll marry one lady, you still want another one. That's the problem. Still have to control the mind, still have to control the senses. So the brahmachari ashram is sort of a little bit neglected ashram. Some years ago an attempt was made in a manner, a revival attempt, you know, to sort of from the last of the brahmacharis to kind of get some new sprouts, and well, they have a few now all in maroon sweaters and so on, same socks. Brahmacharis live like that in a community together, all with the same commitment, and that group dynamics that carries the ashram. Grihasthas, they want more independence, they want give more shape to their lives. So, and then you have many who sit on the fence. They don't really want to get married because they can see all the trouble that comes from taking the responsibility. And so therefore, no, I don't really want to be married. But they don't embrace the brahmachari culture. That's not an ashram. Then you are really in a bachelor state. And a bachelor is sort of in no man's land. A bachelor, it's not really on a spiritual path. So better clearly decide. Be married and go that way, or be a brahmachari and go that way. Make it more clear. And then I think also the protection will be more easy. I don't think the boys in the back would have asked that question. So we should choose where we're going to be, you know, like really. And being married is not a necessity for dealing with lust. The process itself deals with lust. Srila Prabhupada did not just present these ashrams like a choice, kind of, right? Sort of, well, you decide, you know, what you kind of would like. No, it was very clear. If you cannot be a brahmachari, if you really cannot be, all right, then it's a concession you make at marriage. It's not like, nowadays become too much like choice. What shall I do? Well, I guess I'm more of a grihastha. In that way, most will be more of a grihastha. But in Prabhupada's time, most were more of a brahmachari. So that's interesting. So maybe some of the Pandavasenas would like to become a brahmachari. I mean, say one more thing. I have one disciple who I met in Switzerland, who came from India, and he was working in a bank. So when I met him, I asked him, I said, oh, you're working in a bank, very nice. Are you married or getting married? He said, no, I'm not married. So no, I'm not interested in getting married. I said, oh, are your parents in need of, you know, of your country? He said, no, they're well off, they're fine. I said, then why do you work in a bank? Just become a brahmachari. And he did. He became a brahmachari, he went to Chokrati, and now he's heading up a base somewhere in Sangam near Nasik, and he's been happy ever after. So it's not too late. You're welcome.
Krishna Maharaj, can I ask a follow up question, please?
No, follow up question for you. No, that was, isn't it?
When, yeah.
Yes, it, yes, it yes, okay, yeah. Yes, of course, of course.
Thank you. So, from what I understand, you're saying that the brahmachari platform is more supreme to the Grihastha platform. But if that was the case, then would it not be, if all of the Pandasenas here became Brahmacharis and didn't have children, then are we not missing out on a chance to maybe have God-conscious, Krishna-conscious children by becoming a Grihastha and then bringing up children in a Krishna-conscious environment? Because surely if everybody became a Brahmachari, then I suppose the future of ISKCON might be questionable. If everyone is a Brahmachari.
Well, interesting. It's sort of like in another tradition, they have that approach: have as many children as possible, and that way your religion will expand, isn't it?
Yeah.
So that's one approach. When I said, it's not that the Brahmachari ashram is spiritually better than the Grihastha ashram. The only good thing about the Brahmachari ashram is that it saves you an awful lot of time. See, the Grihastha ashram, it's amazing how much time it takes. I myself have been in all the four ashrams, and that was the realization was when I became a Vanaprastha. I had so much time. I chanted extra, I read extra. There's still a time left over. That didn't happen in the Grihastha ashram. So in that sense, the Brahmachari ashram, or a renounced platform, is favorable, especially because time and energy is more available for Krishna. Brahmacharis, they have another way of multiplying themselves than the Grihasthas. Right? They do that because they're not so caught up in maintaining the family, so they can spend their time in making devotees instead and simply preaching. And in that way they multiply themselves, whereas Grihasthas have their own way of multiplying themselves. So I think when we go into these kind of discussions, if there only would be Brahmacharis, that will never happen, don't worry. I personally am more worried if there only would be Grihasthas. And I think that, and that's why I spoke a little bit in favor of the, how about being a Brahmachari? Mm. Why not consider it? It's not bad.
Thank you.
Next one, of course, for my action.
Yes, Janaki Ram Prabhu.
Maharaj, the question a devotee asked me earlier on about how can we measure spiritual advancement? You know, because always we're looking for proof, or does this process work for me? And doubt comes, is this a placebo effect? Or is it just because I've been in this movement for such a long time, I want it to work so badly that I'm making my mind think, okay, this process works? You know? So I was just wondering if there is any tangible way where we can measure, you know, that we're making spiritual advancement, and mm-hmm. thereby we can continue with the process.
I would like to say that there are two tangible ways to, at least two, there may be more, tangible ways how you can see that you are advancing along the road. I think it is very important to sometimes see if you can make these this advancement. There is one negative way or something and one positive way. What I will speak now is a litmus test. A litmus, it comes from a the word comes from a scientist who developed a piece of paper, and then you could put it to the fluids of the body, and the way the paper would color itself, would indicate how much acidic you are in your urine, and you know, if the balance between the alkaline and acidic portions in the body is right. It's a litmus test, a test which any individual can apply without needing to go to other sources. So one litmus test you can apply to yourself is really how much you have become free from lust. Lust being the main attachment to this material world. And if you make spiritual advancement, or if you want to make spiritual advancement, you must decrease the attachment to the material and increase the attachment to the spiritual. It's just like where I live, there is a rowing boat, and if I want to row on, and I may work and work and work and work, but my rowing boat is not moving forward unless and until I tie it loose from the anchor. So if a person makes all kinds of efforts in his spiritual life, but he remains bound and anchored by lust, his progress is theoretical, not practical. That's one way you can apply a test. It's a very, you need a lot of honesty for this, or not a lot, some clear vision you need to see. The other test is, how much am I becoming attached to Krishna? How much do I relish really sitting and in the kirtan, or reading the books, or staying with devotees, or going on Harinam? If I just do not relish this and it becomes a sublime torture for me, it means my advancement is still not very great. So these two things, how much do I become detached from material attachments to sense gratification, and how much do I become attached to Krishna? Now, something strange can happen sometimes. This is talked in the Bhagavatam. You can sometimes see that a person develops attachments in Krishna consciousness. He really likes to be with devotees. He likes to be in Goloka Dham, even though it's so cold in the morning. And he likes to be in lectures, although they are sometimes boring, especially when they are given by Sachinandan Swami, and so on. But he likes, some attachment to the process is there. At the same time, he watches, there is a certain helplessness. This is explained in the 11th canto. Such a person is like a person who wants to give up drinking very much, but he remains somehow attached to it. First he puts the bottles of wine away into the cellar. Then, after some time, he thinks, well, what if I have a non-devotional guest, like a policeman, and I need to offer him wine? So he puts him in the cupboard again of his living room. Then he thinks, well, if I have such a guest, like a politician, I should recommend the right type of wine. So let me just taste it a little, but then spit it out immediately. So he does that. Then he has the wine in his mouth, and then one gulp is nothing. Then he drinks one gulp of wine, and again has become a wine drinker. So so it can happen that you want to, that you understand material sense gratification does not bring a good end. Like when I look at this movie, I know I will want to look at another movie afterwards. Or when I go out and go discoing, maybe one of or two of you are doing it. I know I wake up in the morning with a heavy head and I'm quite disturbed, you know. But one cannot leave it as of yet. At that time, one becomes like a drunkard who drinks but who curses himself. Why did I do this? Why did I have to do it? Do you know this situation? Everyone looks on the ground. Only a few bold people nod their heads. What to do at that time? One, in other words, our simple test doesn't work so well here. One is attached to bhakti, but one is also attached to maya. What should one do? Krishna makes a statement in the Bhagavatam. He says, my devotee should remain happy. No problem. He should continue to listen very, very much about my pastimes, my narrations of my pastime, and after some time, the remnants of his material attachments will go. So I've given three answers to your question, Janakiram. My first is, yes, you can measure your advancement by how detached you are from sense gratification. Second parameter, you can see how much do I really appreciate the processes of devotional service. And the third is, if you find yourself in a... You have to help me here. What is this when your foot is... Right foot is in one boat and your left foot is in another boat and you come into a spagat?
split.
It splits your heart in two. When you find yourself in this split, you don't know where this will go. Take shelter, nevertheless, in Krishna, in hearing about his pastimes, and that will take care that soon, after some time, these remaining material attachments, which linger on like the addiction of the alcoholic, they will go also. Harik, that's a hopeful message, isn't it? Yeah.
I have one thought.
Please. Yes.
It's about devotees who are around for a long time, and they struggle. And they have definitely some of these material attachments and so on, and still their bhakti is maturing over time. We see that although they may not be strong in their practices, and when we look at them externally, we think, oh, they're not very advanced, right? But we see that internally some growth is still happening, and sometimes even these devotees come out with some very deep understandings and deep realizations. I mean, you can underbuild that on the verses of Bhagavad Gita, Apichet Sudra Acharo, Bhajate Mamananyavak, and if you are reading which is the verse that even if a devotee is engaging in abominable activity, he's still saintly. Vishnu Chakravarti Thakur's commentary on that verse, 9:30, is very significant because he asks some questions and he says, yes, somebody will very soon be righteous. That means after he gives up his sinful activities. And Vishwanath said, no, he is righteous now, even although he has not given up these abominable activities. He said, because he's still a Vaishnava. Mm-hmm. Despite of the fact that he is engaging in all these activities, still a Vaishnava, and therefore he knows that he's... what is the right course of action. He knows he's fallen. Therefore, when we see a senior devotee who is not always following so nicely, we will not maybe place him on the Vyasasan, because that's... one who sits on the Vyasasan must be free from fault. But still, we should also not put these people, these kind of devotees, down and think that, oh, they are just fallen, they're neophytes. No, they have maturity and sometimes can really make also deep contributions to the community of Vaishnavas. What do you think?
Yes, very, very nice contribution to this question. Other questions?
Hare Krishna. We had one seminar which we talked about Madhuri Kadambini. We talked about different stages, but I didn't really, I don't know if, maybe I haven't understood it properly, but I don't know if it really says like how to move from stage to stage. It just talks about each stage. Are there like different practices or different moods we should adopt when, say, if we think we're at Shraddha, then to move to Sadhusanga or Sadhusanga onwards, is there any particular thing we should try and focus on?
Sometimes we have a model of the process of Shraddha to Prem, which is like a ladder. And begins with Shraddha, faith, initial faith, then Sadhusanga, association with devotees, then Bhajana Kriya, regulated process, then Anartamavitti, Nista, becoming firmly fixed, then Ruchi, taste, Ashakti, deep attachment, Bhava, ecstasy, and Prem as the topmost level. And when we look at the model like a ladder, the reason why that is done is because at different stages one may have a specific focus. So in the beginning the focus may be, do I believe this or not? Am I accepting this Krishna consciousness or not? So Shraddha is the big phase. Then we come to that, yes, I guess it's true. Then we come in Sadhusanga, association of devotees. Now that becomes the thing. And as soon as we're with them, they will engage us in devotional service. So like that, each phase leads to the next. So that is one model of understanding this Shraddha to Prem. I can also offer you another model. That model is the model of a box graph, right? Like boxes. So, and there we see in the box graph is that some of the boxes grow simultaneously. Like, for example, you meet a devotee, you get a little bit of sadhusanga, and as a result, you get a little bit of faith. And you also get a little bit of anartha nivritti, you get a little purified by the association of that devotee. Now, as we are, and that will bring us after some time to more sadhusanga, and then some of the other boxes also come up. We even get a glimpse of taste sometimes. Now, in the graph, there is a minimum line. So when finally a box comes to the minimum line, yes, when our Shraddha begins to grow, and say, yes, now it has reached the minimum line, okay, now our focus grows. So this is a more natural way of depicting it. Because if we're looking at the ladder, it's in a way, all these things are happening simultaneously. Yes. We are simultaneously getting purified as we're getting association of devotees, and our faith will grow side by side. Some taste will be there, but it may not have come to the minimum line. When it comes to the minimum line, then we speak, okay, now the stage of Shraddha, now we are really focusing on the stage of Sadhusanga. Each of these stages has to be filled to the minimum line. If they are not, and if we skip one stage, yeah, say you have come to Shraddha, you have some trust that this is the truth, you're with the devotees, you're practicing, you're bhajana kriya, you're regularly chanting, now you have to become purified, and you jump immediately to the higher stages where devotees of Ruchi and Bhava are preoccupied with. So then that stage which you have not given attention to stays hollow. And later on, it will break. Your spiritual life will break. You have to fill it all in. So we have to properly fill in the stages. So, therefore, for many of us, purification is something in the foreground, because we are now in the association of devotees, we are practicing, we're chanting. So therefore, the first three stages are to an extent going on. Shraddha, Sadhu Sangha, Bhajana, Kriya are going on. But now the purification. Yes, so we must do devotional service, we must look for mercy, we must look for opportunities to become purified. And that, it's not that at one stage one says, so, now I have done that, now I can retire. I retire from looking for purification. No, it goes on forever. One will always look for purification. Even when one comes to Nista. Right? Nista means we become very firmly fixed in that Krishna consciousness is more important than anything else in our life. And we can easily abandon other material things. We just give them up and we're just firmly fixed. Still, we keep on looking for purification. Still, we're looking to improve our sadhusanga. Still, we're working on the quality of our bhajan kriya, even when we're at Nista. So even when we go forward in these stages, we keep on investing in the stages behind. And we keep on working on it. Even when one is having some ruchi, one is still thinking, how can I improve my japa? How can I deepen my faith? How can I learn to deal properly with the acharya? So each time we go forward, always keep on investing in the stages behind us. In that way, we make sure that they're all full and that neither of them remains empty. But if we try to look ahead all the time, oh, the other day I cried in the kirtan. Oh, bow, bow, bow. Then some stages may be hollow. And later, the spiritual life may break.
How can we care for devotees and cultivate devotees without becoming burnt out?
Could you hear it, Mark?
I'm not sure. Did you say how can we care for devotees without becoming burnt out in the process?
Well, like people who are new to the movement.
When, yeah. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's a very good question. If you are interacting with many people, you should know that very often a subtle exchange takes place. You give something to them, and they also can influence you. If you are not strong, something comes from you, something comes from them. And if you want to be a preacher, you must see that your own cup remains full. If you give so much and to the other people, your cup may become empty, and their things, their thoughts, their moods, their attachments will come into your little cup. So my the advice for preachers is that they, although anyone who shares, you must fill your consciousness with Krishna consciousness. It's very, very important. Otherwise, you do not have anything to give. I want to now add something to this. This is a general rule which all preachers should take note of. Did you all understand this? Mm-hmm. If you want to give something, if you want to be vibrant outside in your contact, you need to fill up your batteries. You need to see that you are spiritually strong. I would like to now say something which is so wonderful, which I gleaned from a discussion with Naveen Krishna Prabhu. Do all of you know Naveen Krishna Prabhu? We had, after the Buckland retreat, a discussion with those who organized it. You remember, I was not able to attend that retreat due to the surgery and that it was healings, so that a complication had actually developed afterwards. So we met on the Skype, Naveen Krishna and the other organizers of the Buckland retreat, and we asked the question, how did it go? Apparently it went very well with the different workshops which were offered by senior members of the Pandava Sena. But then we looked at this idea of caring for others, like you say. And Naveen Krishna made a very nice observation. He said, if we only think of caring for the members by you know, solving their problems, preaching to them, giving them a cup of warm tea, which is enhanced with 2 spoons of honey, and so on. If we have that type of devotee care, we are missing out on something. Because a person really gets the support he wants or he needs in the moment he cares for others. He goes out of his way. He goes on Harinam. He goes on book distribution. He does something for the benefit of human society. Because the moment a person does something in devotional service, he is maintained and cared for by him, by the Lord. There is an ancient little story in India. There was a man who was totally frustrated with his life, and his wife had left him, and his oldest son called him a jerk, and his health was failing, and now on top of it he had developed lumbardic back problems, and so on. So he went to a saint and lamented and said, can you please help me? And the saint said, yes, I want to ask you a question. Have you already taken care of somebody? The man said, what? I came here to get care, not to give care. The saint said, I'm asking you, have you already done something for the benefit of others? The man left the saint and went somewhere else. And then the saint turned to his disciples who sat nearby and he said, I'm so sorry for this man because he does not know. If we actually do something for the benefit of others, if we care for others, the Lord cares for us. So I want to tell all of you, if you are suffering and things don't go well and the examination, oh, you're not prepared, and now on top of it the best friend of yours has written you a goodbye letter and so on, at this moment it's time to go out on Sankirtan. It's time to go out on Harinam. It's time to do something for others and not be like a little hamster in your own wheel of suffering and turn around the suffering. That's a very nice observation. And believe me, Kandamba Kanana Maharaj and myself know this. We were, as young people, when we joined the movement, we were we were always engaged in Sankirtan, in big responsibilities, and so on and so forth. And that's how you really get a lot of care and a lot of support. This is divine care and divine support. Krishna. You all look a little sleep deprived. Am I right? No? Not. And some of you nod their heads. Yes, please. Yes.
Quite you mentioning in the class, I think, yesterday about the shooting incident in Vrindavan.
Uh-huh.
I wonder if you can maybe share some light on that and how that impacted your Krishna consciousness and your experience from it.
The shooting incident in Vrindavan. Well, someone asked me what was the worst moment, right, in my time in Vrindavan. And it said it was not the shooting incident, but it were rather those moments that I did not really apply myself to all the mercy that I was getting. That shooting incident was a special mercy of Krishna. And somehow or other, it was a political situation. I was in charge of the temple president, and it was very complicated because in Vrindavan you're not only president of the temple, but you're in a town which where local people also have vested interests. You're a very wealthy temple, so there's land, there's property, there's mafia, there's all kinds of things like that. So in the context of all that, you can understand where possibly a shot could come from. Yeah. It didn't have a signature on the bullet though, and the shot in the back, so I wasn't quite sure ultimately who did it. But leaving that side for what it is, who did it, why they did it, I guess you can see the environment. What did it do to me, you know? Besides that the bullet plowed through me in slow motion, that I had three thoughts. I got shot, the second one, it's an inside job, the third one, don't black out. Those were all practical reflexes, you know, of how to survive. And somehow or other, I was shot in the bathroom. I knew I had to go outside. It was difficult, but with some pranayama, I managed to control the pain and pull myself up. I got outside and sat on the veranda. And devotees didn't understand that I was shot. They thought I had an electric shock. And at that point, it looked like I wasn't going to make it to a hospital in time, and I was getting ready to go. And that's where it gets interesting. It gets interesting in that. And as I was sitting there, it wasn't difficult to think of Krishna. It was very natural to think of Krishna, because when we are in trouble, we think of Krishna, and I was definitely in trouble. So I was thinking of Krishna. I was not forgetting him at that point. I was approaching death, and I was definitely thinking of Krishna. But then again, I also noticed there and then that I wasn't thinking of Krishna in deep love. I was lacking in love. And that was the one thing. And I was thinking, if I get out of this, and if I get another chance to live longer, then I hope that next time I will come to this point of almost dying, that I will have more love for Krishna. Well, thinking all that, you know, then I should still live a long time, because I still don't have much love for Krishna. But connecting with what Satchinanda Maharaj was discussing, love for Krishna comes from giving. It's not only that from giving comes spiritual strength, but giving is a symptom of love, right? And it is that by acting in that loving way, by giving, one will gradually develop love. A Vaishnava is not just giving some charity, you know, digging in a purse and pulling out a coin, you know, like a pound, you know, a pound for you, or some shillings or whatever. No, A Vaishnava is known for his generosity. A Vaishnava is one who gives himself and who's ready to give everything. And it is there which is what turns everything around. So this shot was a turning point in my life which gave me a different direction. It really gave me a lot of determination to go more in depth now. And I knew I'm back on bonus time. Even my hand, the lines in my hand, is interesting because I have a double lifeline. And
Oh yeah.
You're looking at the wrong hand, Maharaj. But that's for ladies, the left hand.
Dude, yeah. He really has.
What to do? I have a double lifeline. So it's quite clear, you know, I'm on my second lifeline. And now, according to the book of palmistry, not everyone has one, some have. But I'm on my second lifeline, and this lifeline I want to use now very carefully. So, of course, if you have only one lifeline, then I advise you to use that one life, you know, very carefully. You may not have two like me. You may have only one chance, you know. So in that case, develop this culture of giving ourselves. Yes, I can do it. Oh yes, can I do it? Yes, please, yes. Can I do that service? So that kind of eagerness is bringing out that giving spirit, which will help to cultivate our love. Yeah, so many interesting things were in that shooting, of course. But, you know, at one point I was unconscious for a long time, and I went out of my body and I looked down, and okay, it's lying there. I went through the wall because I wanted to know where I was. So I came outside and I saw, oh, it is the Methodist hospital in Mathura. And I made this. And then, as I had sort of gone around, I saw a car coming. He said, that's our temple car. And I saw the devotees sitting in there, Burija was sitting in the front, right? And they were coming to visit me, so I thought, oh, I'd better go back. Nobody home, you know. Of course, when I went back, I was unconscious again. So I only, you know, but still, I remember that distinctly.
May I just out of the interest, was it painful?
It's a bit painful, yeah. Yeah. It's like this piece of metal goes from the back to the front. It hurts.
Did it come out again?
Or? No, they had to operate.
Yeah.
But it's not only is it very painful, but it's sort of a pain that it's not localized anymore. The whole body, everything becomes drawn into it. It's like that kind of pain. So, but pranayama helped me to come out for a moment or two. It helps to deal with pain. And Krishna somehow pulled me through. Yeah, now I'm on borrowed time. I should have been dead, logically speaking. I lost more than 4 liters of blood. So I should have died then. So I knew very well after that I'm on. It's a gift what I'm getting now, and I better use it very carefully, and I always remember that. So I'm trying not to forget that shot. Krishna wants me to use my time very, very carefully. Other story.
Mm-hmm. Yes, Yam Gopal.
When you arrived yesterday, you spoke about like there's four things that are determined in someone's life. One of them was wealth.
Yeah, wealth, the amount of happiness and distress, your wife, if you are marrying or not, that is there by the law of karma, and something which I forgot. This is in Chanakya Pandit's writing, that by the law of karma, we have these four things which are certain. Mm-hmm.
So like, does that mean that no matter what you do, you'll get that amount of wealth? So if you say you didn't go to university, you didn't get a job, you'd still get that amount of wealth. How does that, I know, because it feels like we have a choice of, you know, and if we take a certain choice, we'll get a certain amount of wealth. It looks like at least, and if we take a certain choice, we'll probably get less wealth, but how does that work?
It comes to the question, is everything predestined by karma, or do we have a free choice still inside? And the answer is both is there, karma and free choice. And I would like to give you an example which is I think explaining it. Let us say you take an international flight from Frankfurt to Mumbai. Then by your choice of making of choosing the flight, it's almost sure that you will land in Mumbai. So there is a predestination there. At the same time though, while you are on the flight, you have a free choice to use the time. You can, for instance, strike up a wonderful conversation with someone and make some plan what you will do together when you exit the plane and in Mumbai. You can also get drunk. I mean, we won't do that, but the person can get drunk on the plane and he can get a lot overdoses of French whiskey, and then he gets totally drunk. So within prescribed, within a certain situation, you will find both predestination and free choice. And the free choice again brings different reactions to you. So this is the answer. So yes, it's determined what you get in terms of happiness and distress, but you can also do some things which are good and which create again good act results in the future. Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. I have a question about selfless service and mm-hmm. charity.
I will hand that to okay. because so that is
when we do an act of devotional service, when we try and, like you said, to give, to please, you know, to offer yourself, then in this day and age sometimes we can get a feeling in, if you like, a sort of materialistic feeling from others that may look up to us and they say, oh, you know, he's a good guy. And you can sometimes not thrive, but you can let that respect from others for what seems like a cool thing, quote unquote, in commas, to do, affect you. But how do you continue to do that level of service and apply that level of devotional strictness mm-hmm. in a sense that you're doing it purely for the service of Krishna, purely for the service of others, without it letting you affect your false ego?
Yeah, in the Madhurya Kadambini, there is a reference to that. It's known as Tarangaranjini, which means to enjoy the sight benefits that come from devotional service. So each time devotional service is offering us some sight benefits, some material benefits. We are gradually getting some recognition, we're getting with that some support to do more service. With that support, we get some more facility, and it gradually increases over time. Where people give us lots of money,
yeah.
People give us lots of support, and so on, and how to remain very humble, and how to just remain an instrument of Krishna only, right? Just to say, okay, how to remember that that it is Krishna who is behind all these things, and that he is in giving us a chance, that he's sending us facilities, sending us various talents, abilities, and you can take it away like that. Like you know, in a normal condition, you would have to tie me to one of these poles to hold me back from Harinam. But today, you know, even if you would have brought a tractor, you wouldn't have been able to pull me out of the room, because now I don't have that shakti. It's gone. It's not here at the moment. So Krishna is ultimately giving us abilities. He's giving us facilities, and we have to remember that this is simply a gift from Krishna, and he's given that with a particular purpose, that we use it very responsibly in his service, and not for our own comfort, our own self-aggrandizement. And where that borderline lies, okay, that you have to determine. Some comfort is needed.
Yeah.
There was a brahmachari, I was trying to sleep on the floor. I even for a while was sleeping on old potato sacks as a mattress. Now I'm happy with the bed. You know. And it's not that I became less renounced, it's just that now I'm in my 60s, and now it sort of feels that my back really doesn't want potato sacks anymore. So one has to be very intelligent. And in general, our spirit is, we don't take credit. If others offer us credit, we practice to give that credit to someone else. Say, actually, it's not my credit. So many people worked for this, you know, and they were all supporting me. It's actually their credit. Like this, we always try to pass on whatever credit we receive to others, whatever facilities we get, trying to not use too much for ourselves.
Yeah.
Try to use as much as possible for pushing on this movement, and in that way we can stay safe. But it requires an intelligent endeavor. If we go on automatic pilot, then over the years it may get more and more comfortable, and you know, and with it we may get a little attached to all these comforts and all the praise, and you know, where's my cushion? or more than that, where we may become demanding, which is generally not appropriate. Sometimes a senior devotee may also demand, may also say, this is not proper. One has to offer something to a senior person, but then he does it more for the sake of establishing a principle. Like one of my favorite pictures of Srila Prabhupada is when he sits on this silver throne, and it's a monster of a silver throne, like a big thing with a roof on it, and he's sitting there with an expression, with folded hands, his head leaning a little bit sort of to the side, and looking a bit down, and the expression on his face is apologetic. When I read that expression, I read where that Prabhupada's face says, I know it's a monster of a throne. I'm really sorry that I'm sitting on such a throne. But what can I do? It is my duty. So Prabhupada accepted many, much worship, much facility as a representative of the Supreme Lord.
Is that why it's then okay to reciprocate material gifts from, say, very rich donors who provide money for, you know, schools and temples and deities? Then when it comes to Janmashtami, we put them in the VIP tents. We, you know, let them have a special darshan ceremony.
Yeah.
Is that appropriate for this wider purpose of, you know,
exactly,
devotional observation?
You're putting it properly for the wider purposes of propagating this movement. It doesn't put them in the most advanced bracket of Krishna consciousness, but you know, it is a big thing. If you have a lot of money, it's hard. You know, it's just very hard to separate from it. It's pain, but it's hard. So these men are doing a big thing. It really is. If someone gives, like, you know, hundreds of thousands or £1 million, it is a big thing. Even for a rich man, it's sort of like a million is a million. So they do get special mercy also for that sacrifice. But even if they're not so advanced and partially driven by material pride, anyway, because we need support for Lord Chaitanya's movement, we reciprocate with their material position. When Prabhupada received the governor in Vrindavan during the opening, he set the governor on a seat equal to his. Wasn't that Prabhupada was on the bigger fiasa? No, equal seat. Equal seat. Well, you're a big man in the world? Okay, big man in the spiritual field, so be on equal. And that's important, that we recognize also people's prominence in the world. And even if some pride is there, and so on, for the greater purpose of this world, greater benefit. Thank you.
Arik Shamaraj. In terms of serving the spiritual master, Maharaj, sometimes there are certain rules, for example, I think Naribhita Vilas, there's a certain set of rules you need to follow to be able to serve the spiritual master properly. But sometimes, with the purpose of serving the spiritual master properly, sometimes all the rules are not so easy to be abided by. So, how wrong is it not to be able to follow the rules properly, but your ultimate purpose is to be able to serve the spiritual master properly?
You have to understand the essence of service, the spiritual master, and the external circumstances may change. A very, very good example of understanding the essence is Govinda Das, the servant of Chaitanya Mahaprabhu. Chaitanya Mahaprabhu had this schedule that he would chant and dance in the Puri temple. He would have a kirtan every afternoon where they would circumambulate the temple, and the whole town of Puri would come together to see Mahaprabhu dancing. But before that, Mahaprabhu used to take his lunch, prasadam, and he used to afterwards rest. So during this resting time, Govinda Das would always come and massage the please help me, what is this part? The calves. Because when you dance so much, maybe you have noticed the calves are in need of some sympathy. So Mahaprabhu, on this one day, which I want to describe to you, had eaten his prasadam, and he was now lying down in the door in such a way that Govinda Das could not really enter the small Gambira room. It's almost as if someone would lie there and his legs are in this direction, and if the servant wants to enter, he can't without stepping over Mahaprabhu. So this is something which you don't do to a Vaishnava. What to speak to a spiritually exalted person like a guru, what to then speak of the Supreme Personality of Godhead Chaitanya. But Govinda Das stepped over the body of Mahaprabhu to get into the room, then went from inside the room and began to massage the legs. Before he did this, he said to Chaitanya Mahaprabhu, "Can you move a little bit so that I can enter and do my service of massaging?" But Mahaprabhu answered, "I can't move, I'm so tired. You decide what you're going to do." So then Govinda had decided to step over him. And after he was finished, or in the process while he massaged, Chaitanya Mahaprabhu fell soundly asleep. So Govinda Das, so after Mahaprabhu was waking up, he looked around and there was Govinda Das staying in the room. He said, "Why have you not gone to take your prasadam? You have..." Govinda Das said, "How can I step over you?" Then Mahaprabhu said, "Are? You have already stepped over me to come inside. Now you can also step over me to get outside, and you could have done this." And then Govinda Das said, "Well, for your service, I can step over you 1,000 times. But for my sense gratification and eating, I will not step over you." This is a principle in Guru Seva. We want to serve our spiritual master, and when we do this, extraordinary situations may come up where we can't follow all the rituals and so on, where an extraordinary response to the situation is required. For us, we should never do this. I was once in a situation where I was reminded of this pastime. I was by a complicated series of events asked to massage Srila Prabhupada, and I was there behind him. You know, I had bragged. Satsvarup Maharaj came out. He was a regular masseur, and he said, "Prabhupada has seen my hands are too hot, and I have a fever. So he sent me out. He said I should not massage him, but I should find another masseur. And do you know to massage?" And I boldly said, "I'm the best masseur in Germany." I had no idea of massage. Then when I was brought to Prabhupada, I saw him and I regretted my boldness and my bold lie. I felt like now I'm in the cave of the lion when I looked at Prabhupada, and he looked at me from top to down. And when he looked at me with his eyes which saw everything, I knew he knew I shouldn't be there. And I was so much perspiring. I remember my shirt was embarrassingly wet under the armpits, and I must have smelled. And Prabhupada saw me becoming red like a tomato, and then he said, "Just do your service." He didn't want me to flip out, in other words. And so, yes, I was massaging him, and then he said, "Harder." So I was doing harder. Then he said, "Harder." And I could see how my fingers, which moved up, left some roads on his back or some paths on his back. And I thought, this gets too hard. Then he said, harder! Put all my energy there and did. And I said, oh no, this is not good, you know. Where will this lead to? And he said, harder! And then he became disgusted. It was not hard enough. He said, what do you do for service? Like, look at your useless hands. I was shaking. I said, Prabhupada, I'm sorry, I'm not hard enough, I know. But I'm trying to translate your books. Immediately, Prabhupada's whole demeanor changed. And he addressed me in a very collegial way, asking, how many pages a day you do? Mm-mm. So I gave an exaggerated number. I said, Prabhupada, 17 pages, solid pages, like in Krishna book, without verses and word-to-word translation. Prabhupada then looked at me with his eyes and he said, really? He said, Prabhupada, that's on my best days. I'm doing usually 12 pages. So I do remember being in that extraordinary situation to serve Prabhupada for and to do something which you really wouldn't do in any other situation, to really use all your strengths to give him the heart treatment. I was remembering this, but the pastime with Govinda has a much wider application. In the service of the spiritual master, extraordinary situations come up where you can't follow the guidebook for all this, but you should always know the principle is to please him. If you have that principle in your mind, then you will do extraordinary things, and it's still all right. It's the spirit. To understand also the spirit of Krishna consciousness is all about that. If you do not understand the spirit, you can follow all the rules and you will maybe get it wrong.
Hare Krishna Maharaj. See, going back to one of the first questions, so sorry for going back. I'm currently trying to decide whether to go down the path of Brahmacharya Ashram or to get married. And my concern with becoming a Brahmacharya is I still want to look after my parents when they get older, and I don't want them to feel like I'm abandoning them. So, do you have any advice?
It's it shows your noble heart, you know, and it shows that you care. And you have to see. You have to assess the situation. What do your parents really need? And it would be good if you could now spend some time to generate some savings, which you can put away for them, you know, as a reserve. And then, once you've done that, then you can. Then you must turn to Krishna and put them in the hands of Krishna. Mm-hmm. See? Generally, one who is going a renounced path, right, is putting his dependence in the hands of Krishna. And Krishna, now I am dedicating my life to you. and all my energy will now be in your service. Krishna, some or other, you help me to take care of my dependents. I'm leaving that to you. Life goes on, right? Even without us, somehow or other. We are not indispensable. We should not think that if we're not there, that they'll stop to live. That they'll live. But in order to sort of do something, it's better do it now, in the beginning. And then you can, without distraction, dedicate yourself to being a brahmachari. Because in itself, it's the best way to benedict your parents. Because caring for the body is one thing. We want to care for our parents, for their physical needs, and that is compassionate. But we should see that if we become pure devotees, if we go back to Godhead, we take our parents back to Godhead. So that's the purpose of becoming a brahmachari. The purpose is to say, okay, anya bilasita sunyam, now no more other desire, now only Krishna's interest, no other interest than Krishna's interest. And in that way, we can, our service will benedict our parents in many ways. Even if we don't go back to Godhead, still our service, they share in the credit of our service. So don't just see the material credit that you can give to your parents from your labor, but also see that your parents get benefit from your spiritual advancement. The more service we do for Krishna, the more we exclusively make service to Krishna, our goal, the more we become endeared to Krishna. Then, will he neglect our parents? Will he neglect the parents of his dear devotee? No, he won't. So therefore, ultimately, the greatest benefit we can give our parents is by becoming very much serious in service to Krishna. So you should see both of these benefits. But in order to make sure that later on you have no doubts, no, take the time to wind up your material affairs nicely by leaving something. Rupa Goswami also did something for his family members. He left some wealth for them and then went on a renounced path. So in that way we can progress.
Thank you.
Past 9, we have time for one last question. Mm-hmm. Yeah, just to ask about sense gratification in the spiritual world and sort of its implications. Obviously, in the material world, sense gratification, if it's in the very good, it's negative in general. So I was just going to ask about that.
Yeah, Srila Prabhupada has indicated that in the spiritual world there is chanting, dancing and feasting all the time. So, and there are no, and yes, in the spiritual world we hear that associates of Lord Krishna, they have wonderful feasts. We don't hear usually of doctors who take care of overeating patients. There are no hospitals, which are often the result of excessive material life. You know, people kill themselves with all the sense gratification. In the spiritual world, there are no such reactions. The spiritual world, everything is it's full of bliss. And so on, and it does not get interrupted. The bliss. It is, but it is different than in the material world. Let us not make the mistake to think what we have here. We have so much better then we have so much. What is here is so much more better in the spirit world. It's very different. There was once a blind man who tried to understand milk. His friend had told him milk is the most nourishing foodstuff you can imagine. And then the blind man asked his friend, well, can you describe milk to me? Yes, he said the friend, it's a white liquid. Oh, said the blind man, but what is white? Well, said his friend, white is the color of the feathers of is it called a flamingo. Oh, said the blind man, but what is a flamingo? The friend said, it has a neck like this, here, feel. And the blind man felt his hand, and when his arm, and when he came to the hand, he said, no, I will never drink milk, because if that is milk, it will get stuck in my throat. You follow? Mm. So I want to caution you, never think that the sense gratification in the spiritual world is similar to what we have here. You cannot compare it. It's in a different category. We blind people try to make conclusions about the spiritual world by comparing it to the experience we have here. We make the same mistake as the blind man who tried to understand milk by his friends. Showing him that it's white like the feathers of a flamingo. Yes, but we all hear that this world is full of transcendental happiness. Every step is a dance, but not a dance with aching calves and hurt knees, but a very blissful dance. All you hear there is the sound of Krishna's flute, which is fascinating music, and so on. There is overwhelming love. Sometimes people ask, what will it be like when you reach the perfection of bhakti? And the answer to this question is, in modern language, you will be overwhelmed by divine love. Hare Krishna.
Hare Krishna.